You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, welcome to the Daily Nationalist. This is Matthew Raphael Johnson, unfortunately doing this by myself again. And today is the 13th of July, 2023. Every once in a while, Sven would say that I have to kind of get off the Russo-Ukrainian issues, and I think he's right on occasion. Even I get bored of that. And then, a few days ago, I come across an article. But before we get into that, today we're going to be talking about Zionism. And Sven's position has always been that you can't really be a consistent nationalist and say that an ethnic group, whether it be Judaism or anything else, shouldn't have a homeland. Of course, there's some truth to that, but certainly not absolutely financed by the United States and protected by crazy Protestant fundamentalists. And one of the most obnoxious aspects of Zionism in general is this settler movement. In East Jerusalem, for example, on the 4th of July, Israeli police removed a Palestinian family from their home with really no obvious purpose except to have settler families moving in. So, and this was in the old city. This is not too far from the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the Aqabat Khalidiyah neighborhood. So clearly it's a hotbed of some of these, of violence. The Sablaban family had been living there for 70 years. And they simply were put out on the street as the settlers were dancing and singing vile songs. But there have been settler rampages pretty consistently recently in the Al-Aqsa Mosque area. Israeli settlers stormed the courtyards of that famed mosque, and certainly with the protection of the Israeli police. The Israeli forces are carrying out random ID checks. But in this case, as just a single case study, Israeli forces had surrounded the home. They had a paramilitary unit reinforcing them, set up military checkpoints, and surrounded the house before storming it, of course, surrounded also by the settlers themselves. The Jews were dancing and shrieking with pleasure, it's on video, as the family were physically pushed out and into the street. But this is just one example of an ongoing issue. And of course, it's all on video, in Jenin, in Nablus, in Silwan, Sheikh Jarrah, the old city of Jerusalem. The house suddenly wasn't hers anymore, and this is a common thing. And she said, "I'm surrounded by these Israeli settlers. We're the only Arabs left here. They hate us. You could see one of the settlers dancing around here, happy that they're taking her home from us." The settlers and factions of the Israeli government have sent in private hit squads to terrorize Palestinians, spraying that filthy skunk water, which is essentially sewage, tear gas, rubber-coated bullets, shock grenades. Protesters against this are usually just arrested, assaulted, and of course shot with live rounds, which is pretty normal. If you remember a few years ago, I think it was in 21, we did something on the use of the skunk water. It's a sewage and it remains for weeks. It's chemically treated, so you can't even use water once it dries because it just increases the smell. You simply can't live in the house anymore. The settler group was called the Galicia Settlement Association, clearly meaning that they're from Eastern Ukraine and hence Khazars. They have no connection to Jerusalem or anything there whatsoever. So you have lie number one. Lie number two, was that this association, and it was agreed to by the Israeli courts, the Supreme Court, in fact, that the house was owned by Jews before 1948, which means, somehow, that means they could steal it whenever they want. Well, of course, it's a lie, because the house was built by the Jordanian government, and that's from that point is where this family lived there. The name of the association is from Western Ukraine. And they had been renting the house from the Jordanian government since 1953. And for decades, the family had been fighting these expulsion attempts since at least 2010, if not before. They lost everything they had, even without losing their home, by paying lawyers. As it stands now, you have almost 1 million Israeli settlers. I think the number is about 700,000. Squatting, essentially, in more than 250 settlements, whether it be East Jerusalem or the West Bank. And this is overtly supported by Benjamin Netanyahu, the embattled prime minister. And it's part of the reason why he wants to clip the wings of the judiciary. In fact, as this is going on, I get this hit in May. A bill is being considered that makes flying the flag of Palestine illegal anywhere in Israel. And, as some of you may have noted, this is also occurring at the same time. We're not even getting into the Jenin northern West Bank attacks. Anti-Christian violence, which is always a normal part of Israeli life, is on the rise. It's on the rise to such an extent that the president of Israel, Isaac Herzog, had to condemn it. In fact, there was a memorial ceremony for Theodor Herzl, and I think this was around July 7th, and he said, "I condemn violence against Christians, and it's being done by a small, extreme group towards Christian clergy." So, you know, I don't know, you take that for whatever it's worth. And that's just the very beginning. This huge rise in settlements, huge rise in Zionist militancy is coming in the coalition government of Netanyahu. But of course, you have people like Alon Ben-Mir, you have people like Kit Klarenberg, who can't stomach the nature of the Zionist crimes in the Middle East. And now we get to what I really wanted to talk about, the documents that came out concerning the Nakba. That's the dislocation caused by the initial war against the Arabs to establish Israel, 1948-1949. Israel used, without question anymore, not just chemical weapons, but biological agents to destroy Palestinian villages. Zionist militias engaged in a campaign of this kind of warfare meant to more effectively expel the native Arab population. It was to slow the advance of intervening Arab armies and poison citizens of neighboring states. So the Nakba resulted in, as most of you know, about 80% of Palestine being declared as Israel, the expulsion of almost 1 million Palestinians, deliberate depopulation, the destruction of 500, 700 Palestinian villages, and of course the denial of any right of return. It shattered Palestinian society. But these removals were done through the use of biological weapons on civilian targets. And they were meant to, and did, infect local Palestinians with typhoid, dysentery, and malaria. And they did it by poisoning the wells, contaminating local water supplies. And of course, from there on in, it was there was a concerted cover-up, both by the media and the Israeli government. And there's a paper that's just been declassified that proves this. Let me quote Klarenberg for you here. "The paper reveals that the water supplies of several Arab villages, towns, and cities were targeted by Zionist militants even before the war, and that biological warfare was seen by Zionist militants at the same time to have been pivotal in the permanent capture of Palestinian land and expulsion of local residents. Take, for instance, the Zionist poisoning of the vital aqueduct in Kabri, a primary source of water for nearby Palestinian settlements, which the paper's authors call the most serious and potent use of biological weapons during the 1948 war, despite it taking place actually before the conflict began. The historic northern city of Acre, which the UN designated a part of a future Arab state, depended heavily on the aqueduct for water. The morale of its inhabitants is said by Morris and Kedar to have been already shaky when local supplies were poisoned due to the recent Zionist conquest of nearby Hafia. the region's capital. So there were Israeli academics that did expose this document. And these are the same people, it's already mentioned, when they broke the story, were trying to diminish its significance. That this was a failed strategy that was immediately abandoned. Well, documents from the IDF show this to be a lie, and it comes from the Jewish Settlements Archival Project, and that's found at New York University. And it shows in great detail how the Israeli occupiers employed these same tactics in order to purge Palestinian areas and to make way for these settlements in the West Bank and everywhere else. Let me quote him again here. Zionist militants had for some time been targeting Arab soldiers directly with biological weapons. In late May that year, Egypt's foreign minister sent a cable to the UN Secretary General announcing the arrest of two Zionist agents who admitted that they had been instructed to contaminate the springs from which the Egyptian troops at Gaza drew their water supply. The pair acknowledged having dropped typhoid and dysentery germs into nearby wells, which were found to be in possession of several bottles containing a liquid which was discovered to contain the germs of dysentery and typhoid, as well as a canteen containing a liquid with a high concentration of typhoid and dysentery germs. Now, many of you also know that Israel has refused to sign the 1975 Biological Weapons Convention, which was a UN under UN auspices, and the same for the 1997 version, the Chemical Weapons Convention. And it implies, of course, that Israel will continue to use this. Israel maintains these weapons at a high level of readiness, the same way for their nuclear arsenal, in anticipation of the day when they may be losing a war and will pull out all the stops. Now, in November, this is a while ago, this is 1998, the Sunday Times, Great Britain, strangely, this isn't normal for them, they reported that the Israeli military, and their American allies, of course, was working on a biological weapon that would harm Arabs, but not Jews. Now, for the poisoning of the wells, as well as for this, the American media was screeching that this is blood libel. But, of course, today, it's demonstrated to be true. But the implications of this are far-reaching. Israeli and American chemists are seeking, or have sought, to identify and thus target genes that make Arabs Arabs, versus what makes a Jew a Jew, which, at a minimum, means that they are both well-defined ethnic groups. Now, back to the settlements. You go back to 1967. Six-Day War meant that Israel could annex large parts of the surrounding territory from neighboring Arab states. So this is the beginning of that particular element of the occupation, and is where the settlement movement in our era really came from. Now they yell, you know, the Arabs say that this is absolutely illegal under international law, and you have to roll your eyes. Well, who cares? That has nothing to do. First of all, I don't need international law to know this is a bad thing, and quoting it doesn't help because there's really nothing behind international law. Ultimately, it's just a rhetorical device more than anything else. But, you know, that's as far as it goes. And the UN, to which credit, has condemned it over and over again. Now, initially, they said, way back, they said that these settlements are the work of individuals and, you know, wealthy entities, not government agencies, like the Jewish Agency, for example, World Zionist Organization. And Tel Aviv said, we don't approve of this, but we also can't stop it. We all know that that's a lie. In January of 1971, Golda Meir was prime minister, and they met, again, recently released documents, they met to discuss the forthcoming construction of these settlements. But they realized how rotten this policy was, because you have to remove Palestinians to make this happen, and they admit that they needed unfailing secrecy here. And they had the media in their pocket, but you never know what may happen. So Meir refused to attend the opening ceremony. She says explicitly that we really can't be talking too much about settlements. We just have to kind of do it. And she says here, she says, I'm asking ministers for the sake of our homeland to hold back, talk less, and do as much as possible. But the main thing, as much as possible, talk less. In other words, don't give anyone any information. Don't give anyone who is not in our circle a quotation. That would mean that we are actually behind this. And there was an oath of silence, April 1972. And Yisrael Galili, who was a minister without any portfolio, told everyone working under him that you do not talk about this to the press at all because it can cause damage. And what he means is diplomatic damage. And that's roughly when the first settlement, Gittit, in the West Bank. And of course, you have to displace Palestinians from, in this case, the village of Aqaba. And it was done simply by brute force. IDF soldiers came in, started shooting, pushed everyone out of the way and said, we need a training base here, so you're finished. Now, when this happened, the Palestinians ignored them. So then, in refusing to move, they then started smashing up their tractors and tools. They still wouldn't move. So the IDF brought in all manner of vehicles to destroy the crops, to destroy everything that they could. And then finally, they brought in a crop duster that rained toxic chemicals, lethal to animals, dangerous to humans. And of course, this is nothing new, but this is yet another example of the use of biological agents. So the IDF in April 1972 met with representatives of the Jewish Agency's Department of Settlement. And they actually laid out a schedule for this spraying at such a density that it would preclude humans from inhabiting the area for several days for fear of stomach poisoning. So the Jewish Agency, to allow the state to stay out of it, at least officially, got the plane, and the point was explicitly in these documents to destroy the harvest of the Palestinians and then forcibly expel them. So Aqaba's mayor, very naively, wrote to Moshe Dayan, of course, the defense minister at the time. He said, the village has 4,000 residents. We had 145,000 dunams of agricultural land. A dunam is roughly equal to 1,000 yards square. It's an old Ottoman unit of area. And whatever they had been able to harvest were burnt. Now they're left, as he says, with about 25,000 dunams of land. In other words, they couldn't provide for themselves anymore. Of course, if he got a response, it wasn't a very interesting one. But it took until May of 73 for the IDF to take over. And Tel Aviv was asked and granted permission to seize the land for the purpose of establishing a settlement. And 3 months later, construction began. And there's nothing odd about this. This has been the template from then onward. And this began again in 1974. The former IDF general, who became a member of the Knesset, Meir Zoria, lobbied the Jewish Agency to allocate the budget for another area of the West Bank to kick the Palestinians out and to settle Jews there. And of course, the state was in on it. The state was well aware of it, was going to dedicate troops to it. And you have a general, but the funding going through the Jewish Agency back then meant that they had plausible deniability. Later on, of course, Yitzhak Rabin, who was prime minister, said that we're meeting about this budget. We're going to get a budget. And I'm in favor of this work, but we can't say anything about it. And then they took this area, Malaya Adumim. They classified it an A-class area, which meant the settler population there will have greater benefits from the state, despite the fact that they have to, you know, kill people and throw the Palestinians out to get there. And of course, the state giving it that classification is an endorsement, which contradicted what they were saying in public. And things like this, these documents, clearly showing this kind of settlement policy, despite the lies in public, had been hidden for 50 years. Why the Jewish Settlements Archival Project are releasing them now? It could only be that they are convinced that their media is going to downplay them, which of course is correct. And of course, God knows what other documents are in the IDF's vaults that we'll never see, ever see the light of day. Now, this particular project's archives, it ends in 1977, but as of right now, there's not quite 150 of these settlements in the West Bank, and there's an additional 12 in East Jerusalem, and the number of these absolutely fanatical and very violent colonizers, between 500,000 and 700,000. The bitter local resistance continues today. The most obnoxious element of Zionism has been the settlement policy, especially from a group of people who ethnically and certainly religiously don't have a shred of authority to be in this area. And in fact, recently, your Hasidic rejection of Zionism in Jerusalem has largely been solved. And I think all they needed was, you know, none of these people ever work. The Hasidics in Jerusalem don't work. Settlers don't work. They're financed by these very wealthy Jewish agencies, and of course now more explicitly by the state. And it's almost as if the Israeli government was aware that as the decades went on, their control over Western media became so absolute that they could afford now to have the state finance these things, and Netanyahu's saying, I'm not going to do anything about this. He is pro-settler, and his coalition government, especially now that he's in a lot of trouble over this, you know, his control, his personal control and friendship with media agents and getting them to support the government policy in certain things, which is still apparently going on. He's not going to get in trouble for it. I think the courts have already said that. He's now in coalition to support himself with some of the more extreme settler parties, Jewish Power, Religious Zionist Thing, whatever the heck it is. These are all just essentially settler parties. And now he feels secure enough to say, we don't care. But these Taub Center NYU documents being released now is extremely interesting. And of course, nothing will come from them. And the same thing goes for the Jenin, northern West Bank, so-called town of Jenin, but there's a refugee camp, which as of right this second, the Israel's invasion is continuing. The thing is that all witnesses suggest that it's only, you know, there's no army there. So everything they do is against civilians. That's why they have no difficulty attacking hospitals, medical staff, ambulance units, the Palestinian health minister, Maya Kalia, and you have witnesses too saying that they raided the Jenin Public Hospital. They opened fire there. They raided Ibn Sina Hospital. And no one's quite sure the death toll, but there are certainly at least three wounded. But to a man, the witnesses are saying the Israeli forces are destroying infrastructure and public property, using snipers stationed inside armored vehicles, as always, firing live rounds, and rarely at armed Palestinians. Lynn Hastings, the UN humanitarian coordinator there in Palestine, has seconded all this. That she couldn't believe the scale of the operation. She's condemned Israel in no uncertain terms. But for the last 2 years, I mean, it's happened before then, but in particular the last 2 years, they've killed more than 100 people in the refugee camp. I shouldn't even say 2 years, really, 2022, last year. The death toll is increasing. July 3rd, I think, was the latest one. Yet killed six people, but it also provoked a resistance from the Palestinians, which was basically successful, to the point where the IDF had, of course, American Apache helicopters to evacuate vehicles that were stuck in ambushes. Local guerrillas there are fairly experienced. They're using drones quite a bit, the Israelis are. And it's really the first aerial attack in almost 20 years. Now, the camp is at the heart of this city. It's roughly a quarter mile square, home to about 15,000 refugees who have been there, by the way, since 1952. It was in 2002. Israel launched a 10-day military campaign there, killed at least 52, and destroyed the camp, destroying what existed of the civilian homes and displaced those who were already displaced. And I want to note, as this was going on, precisely as this was going on, what was going on in London? The British Parliament was considering a bill that would ban the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement outright. You know, they can't just, you know, they have to ban it. This is all these people can think about. This is an unprovoked genocide. And yet London, of course, is defending its Jewish client. One of the bills here is under the Economic Activity of Public Bodies Bill. And really, its sole purpose is to ban any public institution, including local councils, from supporting any boycott that target, quote, foreign governments, basing their boycott on moral or political grounds. I don't need to tell you this is not going to apply to Russia or Syria or Iran. I am telling you, though, that it is no accident that this is occurring precisely at the same time the Zionists are destroying the refugee camp at Jenin. It's not bad enough that they're in a camp. They're shocked. Absolutely shocked that they might dislike this. Their unemployment's like 80%. Israel has the whole place under lockdown. The fact that they may be angry and fight back to them is just absolutely incomprehensible and outrageous. And one of the more rotten individuals here is, he's finance minister under Netanyahu, who's also the head of the Religious Zionism Party, Bezalel Smotrich. And he's been given Netanyahu's agenda, almost total authority over the West Bank. And his sole real purpose, the same thing as his Religious Zionism Party, he's overseeing settlement development. He is laying out, now they used to hide this, now they're confident enough to do this out in the open, hopefully starting a war with Iran that will, you know, deflect from all of this. He's now in charge of, you know, both settlement and occupation policy. And Israel, of course, maintains full security and civilian control. Anything the Palestinians have comes from the outside, and most of that has now been destroyed. Now, a member of his party, that same party, occupies an important position in the security ministry as of last month. And that person also plays an important role in selecting the leader of the civil administration concerning all of the occupied territories going back to 67. And that person, this party, one of the more extreme ones, coordinates Israeli government actions there. But the Religious Zionism Party is essentially a settler party, which means that that group, for the first time, one of these fanatical groups now has total power over both Palestinians and the settlers in the West Bank. Another one, a party called the Jewish Power Party, as if we don't already know, Ben-Gvir, who's the head of the Jewish Power Party, has the so-called National Resilience Minister, a member of this party, Yitzhak Wasserlauf. He's also in charge of Negev and Galilee. And he has been put in charge of overseeing Nakab and Galilee settlements. Now, those have been occupied since 1950, not even 1948. And his appointment, and this is from a press release, this was part of the creation of a new body to ease the path towards legalizing about 70 illegal outpost settlements in the West Bank. So clearly, things like settlement development, these kind of phrases, development of initiatives and production, these are code terms used in, you know, concerning the Golan Heights, West Bank, Nakab. They're references to reinforcing, consolidating, and expanding Jewish settlements there. So not only does it justify previous land seizures and home demolitions, but it will increase the seizure of these Palestinian lands and the demolition of their homes, and of course the displacement of those who live there. But this has been a process that's been the core of Zionism since 1948. But when you have, these used to be very small parties that had one or two members of the Knesset, but these parties are now in government. The most extreme and fanatical settler parties, Ben-Gvir or Smotrich. So Gvir has control over Galilee, Smotrich has control over the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The enforcement of these policies is going to be violent, whether or not even the rank-and-file Israeli wants these people in charge of this because it simply endangers their life. That's another question. So Smotrich, without any shame, instructed the Israeli government agencies and ministers, and I'm quoting here, to prepare themselves to accommodate an additional 500,000 settlers in the West Bank. And of course, for that, to prepare themselves to develop infrastructure and services in these settlements and outposts. And this is going to be billions of dollars. The U.S. has always been very uncomfortable with this, but they're going to give in. Not only that this is a fundamental task of the government, as Smotrich says. Because he's in trouble, because Netanyahu's in trouble, he figures his best hope is to side with something. I mean, he's always liked them, but now this is an explicit acceptance and support of these, the most extreme of the Zionist movement. And of course, back in 2005, you had the disengagement plan, where settlements were being demolished. This is now long gone. And ultimately, only four settlements in the northern West Bank were dismantled, and a handful in Gaza. But that's long gone now. Now we're talking about legitimizing these settlement outposts in the northern occupied West Bank, and then facilitating their return to those like Gunin and Kadim and these places that have been dismantled previously. I know this has been quite depressing, but this is what's happening in Israel now in the most cursory description I could come up with. And it's simply getting worse. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I will talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.